You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7
Avalon.
How you doing? This is Ron Trupa with the Catalina Film Society and the Catalina Film Festival. This weekend we have a special screening called Summer Children, a film that was shot on and around the island in 1965. And on the phone with us today, we have the producer, Jack Robinette, as well as the restoration producer, Edie Robinette Petrocchi. And they're going to be talking about the film that you can see this Saturday night, tonight at 7 p.m. So come out and see their art house film work. Jack, Edie, how are you guys today?
We're doing great.
We're great. We're excited to share Summer Children with the people on Catalina. I've talked to a couple of the participants. One, John Kohanic, who played Frankie, and his first statement was what a memorable experience it was. And our head lighting man and camera operator is still working after all of these years, and he's on location right now as a camera operator. And he was born and raised in Avalon, and he was telling me that his last job on Avalon was assistant harbor master. And he also was a boat operator for Bill's shore boat service.
Huh.
He was telling me that at that time when he was a student, I mean probably kindergarten or first grade through high school, they had a one-room school, and it had three sections of blackboard, one for elementary, one for middle school, and one for high school. And they had three rows of seats. And when you graduated from elementary school, you went to the next row. And when you graduated from middle school, you then went to the high school. All of that was taught by one teacher while he was there. So you were mentioning how Avalon has changed. And, of course, he laughs about it. How it's changed, and of course, it lives on the mainland now.
Is his name Greg?
Bernie Reed.
Okay, I see Ernie Reed right here. I'm looking at your IMDb listing as we speak. So he was a gaffer on, and he also operated the camera as well.
Yes, he was one of the originators of the Camera Operators Guild.
But I think one of the really fascinating things about Summer Children, about the artistry here, Ernie Reed's a dear friend of the DP, Vilmish Sigmund, but Vilmish had the great joy of being able to operate his own camera. So that's one of the really special things. He was able to just draw in all of the organic, you know, natural beauty of the ocean trip over to Catalina as well as on the island, and do his own camera work, which later in his career, you know, as you know, with the unions, you have to hire a camera operator. But Jack can attest to the fact that I believe they worked on several projects following Summer Children. This was sort of a springboard for them getting to know each other.
Sure. Now before we talk about the film itself, I just kind of want to ask you guys some questions about being filmmakers in general. How did you start to get into film, and then, you know, I guess eventually leading up to shooting this in 1965, which not everybody was running around with cameras back then. It's not as easy as it is today with digital technology and semi-professional cameras in the hands of most filmmakers.
Yeah.
Well, I started out working in television when I was in college and was a cameraman at a local television station, as well as cameraman on an ABC network show called Ozark Jubilee. So I went from that to being in the military and officer in charge of television for the country of Korea, and then went to Universal Studios and started working my way up. And when I was at Universal, I met Jim Bruner, who was the director of Summer Children, and we talked and ended up saying, let's do what's necessary to make this movie. And so I quit at Universal, and he and I went to work. And then...
You have to tell him a couple of your stories from Universal, Doug. He's being a little modest here. He has one of the fastest career trajectories there. You were in the mailroom, 2 weeks, and then you became an assistant to production managers, and you did the budgets for...
I did budgets for two Hitchcock films, Marnie and the Birds. I was a production assistant to production managers for several of the key television shows at that time, McHale's Navy, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Bob Hope Presents, Wagon Train.
Wow.
So I did have a chance to work on those films, but I was more or less a production assistant and a budget person. So I've worked into and to being a line producer and working from there.
That's see, sometimes it takes another person to brag about you if you're too humble.
he has a lot of amazing stories of work that he did. People he socialized with. Jack was a very popular tennis pro around Beverly Hills, and he got to meet really notable people. And it's a really I wanted to write a script about it one day because he was invited to their homes and did a lot of fundraising. Coming in first as a tennis pro, but getting to know everybody. So,
I would say my highlight of my film career was having Gene Kelly as a doubles partner in tennis. So,
that's awesome.
that sort of overcame all of the other things. And then, of course, I guess the second highlight was working with Vilmos, both originally when he was our director of photography and also then during the restoration where Edie and I would work with him on...
Frame by frame.
Yes, on all the little details of the look of the film.
Yeah, that was just an incredible...
That's amazing. You're listening to Catalina Film Radio. On
KISO
88.7
Avalon. In Hungary, he went to the film school, the one film school they had in Budapest, and he studied a lot of studio art, a lot of art history, a lot of paintings. And if you listen to the commentary track on the DVD, he gets into the importance of his education and how that formed him for his entire life. And he still today learns. He's always seeking out the next challenge to learn, and he's in his 80s. He just says, you know, a great artist must learn for their entire life. And, in fact, that's what sets him apart. And you can tell there is a lot of art history evidenced in his work on Summer Children. That's what makes a low budget, a micro budget indie art house film, so beautiful is that he had that wonderful aesthetic knowledge. And so Summer Children
sure.
is really, I was attracted to it. My film career started in New York. I went to Berklee College of Music. I was originally a singer, but I gravitated over to film, and my start was at Broadcast Arts in Soho in New York. I worked there for several years, and then came back out to Los Angeles and met up with Catherine Hardwick, and we worked on several films and some TV series and just really got involved in various aspects of the craft. Took a break for a little while to get married, and I got into multimedia, so I was able to learn a lot of transferring the workflow from 35mm into digital realm, and then I came back into film after that little detour. And so it's great. I have the knowledge of both of those worlds. So now I'm doing a lot of screenwriting, do whatever performance work I can get, and producing films. So we both come at this from different beginnings, but a lot of similarities in the styles of films that we like. And so it's
that's great. So Summer Children, you hook up with a future Oscar award winning cinematographer, and who also won a Golden Globe and many other nominations for a huge career. So you're starting off with some of the greatest foundation of shooting a film that most filmmakers would love to work with. So even before we talk about the restoration, can you give us a synopsis of the film for people that are about to see it, that don't know about it, or that can go research it?
Well, Summer Children is...
I mean, I could read the synopsis, but sometimes it comes from you a little bit better than me just reading what's online.
Okay, well, I'll try to give you the encapsulated version of that. Summer Children is a coming-of-age film that reveals the angst and confusion of a group of friends as they're trying to discover their own identities during a period in American history where there was a tremendous amount of change. The Vietnam War was about to start, and I think it was just getting underway, and some of the cast and crew sort of disappeared into the Vietnam War and found themselves when we did the met up again during the restoration. But the film really captures sort of the energy and enthusiasm of growing up in Southern California in the 60s. It's a cultural time capsule of the music and a little bit of the fashion and cultural attitudes, mores of the 60s, and it's just perched on the ledge right before a massive amount of change took place for women musically. They're on several different levels, so it's it really takes a look back at Catalina in its natural, beautiful state. I know it's had a lot of development since then, but we think that Summer Children is really pays an homage to the island of Catalina as well, for that time, as a part of one of the great legends in Hollywood history.
And a lot of it also stayed the same as well.
Right. It was a time capsule of the 60s. When you see it, you've seen it. Clothes, dance, hair, everybody's the quote hip talk of that time. It's hard to listen to now today, but we all thought it was very hip at that time.
Yeah, these were the beach hipsters of the day, I suppose. Yeah.
And where did the story come from? I mean, I don't want to give too much away before people see it, but where were the interests lie? I guess was it Norman that wrote, you know, the whole thing from creative idea to script to screenplay?
Jim Bruner wrote the story, and Norman wrote the screenplay. Jim spent some time in the Air Force in France, and as a result, he was very interested in French New Wave, Italian neorealism. I was interested in those since they were not just the plain old studio movie or motorcycle movies that were made at that time. So we were set out to make something different. And Jim had known Norman from their undergraduate days. And so they got together and did the screenplay. And then I did not get involved in the film until after the screenplay was completed. But it was Jim's story and Norman's screenplay, and we then went through all of the regular pre-production, hiring actors, listening to musical groups to get the Deacons, bring Jaime Mendoza Nava to do the orchestrated music. And he had done stuff at, he had been a music writer at Disney, and before that he had studied at Juilliard. He was originally from Bolivia. So we had a great time. Edie called this the tour of the film, the restoration tour, the reunion tour. Pardon me, the reunion tour. Because we did have a reunion, and we've had great fun and times talking to all of these people, you know, many years after it was originally done.
And that was a really
sure, because it's a journey.
It is really a journey.
It was a mental, emotional, physical, and travel journey.
and
you've been to some great festivals with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Slam Dance, San Antonio, Kansas City, L.A. Film and Music.
Yes.
And a very special screening at American Cinematheque at the Brahmins Egyptian. We had a wonderful evening there. Vilmish was able to invite a lot of his friends who are all ASC cinematographers, and Jack prepared a Blu-ray DVD for the event on that wonderful, massive screen. And we had several of the original actors. Jack spoke to one of them this morning, and a lot of the cast and crew came in from Thailand, all over the place, just to join up with Vilmish and have a chance to participate in the Q&A. So that was a really special event.
That's awesome.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and we can talk about the cast as well. I'm interested how independent filmmaking was in 1965. Like, did you get the cast and just be like, you know, we've got someone's yacht, we've got the camera equipment, jump on board, we're going to film this. I mean, you know, were you getting city permits? You know, filming has changed a lot throughout the years. Was it a lot more relaxed back then? I mean, could you literally just start shooting and you know, putting people together? I mean, did you have a budget set aside for this? Or was this a lot of, like, friends
You're
and favors?
You're listening to
like,
Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7.
Favors, like we do a lot today with independent film as well.
We first set out to raise money, and from family and friends, and
again, it's a tennis pro going around raising money.
Whoever we could contact, and then, but it was really pretty organized. We had an office in Culver City, right across from MGM, and we set out to make this as well as possible. I mean, we had casting, we advertised in the Hollywood Reporter, and for our first casting session, one of our funny casting sessions or casting experiences was I took a night class at Hollywood High in French. And so one of the girls who was in that class was Laura Nolan. And so she and I talked, and I didn't know that she had been in two Beach Party movies. And then I called her about being in Summer Children because she wanted to be a real actor, not someone just in a bikini for 2 hours.
Yeah.
So that's how we met and cast her.
You know,
and she had to do some pretty daring things as well. You know, I mean, for 1965, you know, some of the scenes are pretty taboo with, you know, nudity and you know, I mean, that's pretty taboo for 1965.
We was back to our European influence. We were trying to make a European film in black and white in Southern California as opposed to being just like everybody else.
Yeah, the film. Sure. The film was a wonderful example of several really ambitious talented young filmmakers. Some had a little more experience than others. For some, this was their debut. But everybody seemed to appreciate several of the popular European styles, the French New Wave, a little bit of Japanese New Wave, and Italian neorealism. So this is sort of a beach blanket bingo slash film noir slash Fellini film, if you look at it from a stylistic point of view. But I think from the character development, you'll find that it has some austerity and such. It leaves something for the audience to experience. It doesn't just put it all out, you know, on the nose. It's really up to the audience to take away from it what really impresses you. And I've seen this film probably 5,000 times, and every time I watch it, I get something different. It really depends on who I am that day. And I think that's a hats off to the artistry, the freedom that the filmmakers had to do a real genre sort of mashup, you know. It was an interesting window of time, you know. The big studios were starting to break down a little bit, the strictness of the way they were going about production, and a lot of independent producers were starting to pop up all over the place. And there was chaos, but I think there was terrific opportunity, and that's what really attracted me to the film and why I wanted to get involved in the restoration, because I think today independent producers and directors can learn a lot from this film. If you have a micro budget, but you've got, you know, very well-trained people, wonderful artistry, you can turn out something that will withstand, you know, 50 years and longer.
Sure.
In terms of its value. And I think it's we're sort of passing through that new Hollywood period, you know, the 1960s until Spielberg came out and started with his very large tentpole films. There's that whole American New Wave period, and Summer Children was right at the mouth of that river. So it's very exciting from that perspective.
And interesting.
Edie, what was the footage like before you got it into restoration? I mean, you know, what was the quality of it and what was the impetus to make this become a restored piece?
Jack and I, we are of the Robinette family. We're cousins, actually, and we both, for family reasons, took a little detour from filmmaking at one point, and we wanted to get back to it. And he said, you know, there's this one film I did when I was younger. There were difficulties with distribution. Everybody gave up after a while, and nobody knows where it is. And he told me, well, yeah, it was filmed by Wilmer Stigman, and I just about passed out because he's my favorite cinematographer. And I said, okay, we're going to find this. We're going to find it. And
And for people that don't know, Vilmos, he was the DP of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Deliverance, just the laundry list of The Rose by Mark Rydell, who we've given a career tribute to.
The Deer Hunter.
Amazing films.
Yeah, just incredible artist. And so we found it. It was located in three different countries. The pieces that were in Europe, we weren't able to get back here. But we did have a whole print up in Canada, and we found the negatives. We couldn't find all of the music. We had to go back to the actual musicians and get copies, original copies from them in some cases.
Wow.
But we restored from Meg and from Prince, and it was really a joy. And it was interesting to watch Vilmos and Jack, you know, go through their memories from 45 years ago and try to remember all the parts and pieces as we restored it, put it back together. So that was a journey right there. And I felt so honored to be there and participate with them.
A funny thing on the commentary track on the DVD, Vilmos and I, we recorded it twice. The first time in Wilmington, North Carolina, where he was getting ready to shoot a film that still has not been released called Bolden. And so we sat down on a Sunday afternoon in the studios in Wilmington and start recording. So we talked for 2.5 hours for an hour and a half film. So we had to, the result of that was we had to re-record, and then Edie supervised the editing of that to feature Vilmos and to...
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on KISO 88.7
FM. That's funny. Yeah, that's kind of how it always goes, right? You know, all the everything comes back and all the memories and well, how many shoot days did you actually have when you shot the original film?
We probably shot for 3 or 4 weeks. And we did have a couple of different days of pickup shots. But I guess one of the things behind this is our film editor was Marvin Wolowitz, who shortly after Summer Children edited an Academy Award-winning documentary, and then he went on to edit several films and then go strictly into sound editing, where he won 4 Golden Reels for sound editing that's awarded by the sound editors themselves. And we had what we called the Robert Altman Farm Team. Almost everybody that we had working on the film ended up working for Robert Altman. And so, as far as crew is concerned, our script supervisor, Vilmos, of course, he was known for McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and the art director for McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Leon Erickson, was our art director, and he also was the art director for the movie MASH. And so, and in a lot of cases, he actually built those sets on location for Altman. So we had a real good group. Most of them had studied either at UCLA or USC, and for somebody knew them or they knew somebody else to work with them. So that's
were
that's
there challenges for shooting in black and white at the time?
It was a transitional time between black and white and color, but we shot in black and white because we were thought it was more artistic. And Vilmos, we had many discussions with him about that.
You know, this was a fascinating time for Kodak, actually, because they had been, it really was, when the film is stored at the Academy in Los Angeles, and recently I was chatting with a curator there who's taking care of the film that is in pristine condition, even at this point, and he said, you know, you were very fortunate that you were shooting at that time in black and white with Vilmos, because he knew how to get the most out of the very best of, you know, the peak of black and white film quality. So it's really a treat, you know, for people who appreciate black and white art house film, for that matter, you know, specifically.
Sure. Yeah, the clarity of it and, you know, just the panning shots and, you know, just you can see his brain working with his setups and stuff. I mean, and then kind of utilizing the visual of black and white, and you know, to me, black and white fascinates me because it's very foreign to me as a contemporary filmmaker. You know, I'm thinking, like, what kind of makeup did they have to use? Was it as crazy as they used to say? And you know, things are a lot different.
Yes. The big joke then, not so much for us, but for a lot of films, was Hershey's Chocolate was a hit for blood in the black and white film.
Yeah.
Really? Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
See that
stuff fascinates me.
Right. So no, it was,
makes sense.
It was funny.
Yeah. You know, Jack, you might want to speak a little bit to the you're asking about some of the differences in shooting black and white. The lighting that you guys used, I found this fascinating, how you were able to pull this off on the yacht. Vilmos he used as much natural light as possible and just the natural surroundings, picking really good timing to use natural light around the island and on the yacht. But you actually had lighting crew on the boat, did you not?
Yes, we had the light inside the boat, and we used reflectors and so forth on the boat during daylight. So, again, we're talking about the artistry in how to make use of the natural surroundings. And so there's just no question what a great eye he had, he has, he's still working, and he is, he picks up stuff so quickly. He sees things in the frame that I don't think anyone else sees.
Sure, and you also had a nighttime scene, I think, at the beginning with the, was it the racing? Was it night?
Yes, that was at Ascot Park in Gardena. And it was a true race, and we got one person who was a motorcyclist, rider, racer in that. And the good part was he won. And so
that's great.
That was our stuntman for the night. And then John Kohanic, who played Frankie, comes out from behind the crowd riding around. And the guy helping him get off of the bike is actually the racer himself. So all of these things were just – sometimes we had to do things on the fly. We did try to plan as much as possible. But it was amazing. Some, you know, I will say good things happened by accident for us.
And that's sometimes the best part of filmmaking. It's when you stumble over the stuff you didn't expect, the magic.
Exactly. It's funny about our actors. Stuart Anderson, who played West, got a contract as a result of Summer Children. We showed Universal his and Diana's work, and they were both offered contracts. He took a one-year contract, and she turned down a contract, and the end result of that was they both had quite a bit of work after Summer Children. She had a Star Trek that she was the lead person in. She was in the War Wagon with John Wayne, and she called him Mr. Wayne. And Sandy Gabriel, who played Candy, probably had the longest run of anybody. She had 8 years on All My Children playing a part named Edna. And her husband, John Gabriel, who played Seneca on another daytime television program. So that's what they've done. John Kohanic, who played Frankie, was in a Twilight Zone, a Rod Serling Twilight Zone, and he has a couple of interesting stories about what happened to him there as a motorcycle policeman. And then Steve Bobbitt, who played Muffy, was actually just short of 18 when we started. He had just graduated from high school. I thought he was 18 years old. He went with us on location.
He was really good. I mean, he had a great presence on camera.
I agree with you. He was so natural. He just really assumed the role completely. It was just him, it seemed. And
whatever happened to him? What?
He just said he did not have the desire to be an actor. His mother was sort of a screen mother and sort of pushed him into auditioning for the film. And we liked him. He fit the role perfectly. He did a great job. Vilmos made comments that he was one person who could have had a long run as an actor. He just emotionally didn't have it. He went to UCLA after the film, and that was it. He's now retired and living in North Carolina. So it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, he had the it factor. I mean, sometimes it's because I think you don't care, and I think some of the best actors do their homework and then just give it away on camera, and they look so natural and so at ease. And he may have had the opposite, where he didn't have the passion and he didn't care as much, and that kind of transcended through the lens.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
you're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7.
He wasn't
carefree.
Yeah, yes. Very carefree. That's perfect. Yeah, exactly. The musicians, you know, Jack has some good stories about the Deacons.
Yes. But the Deacons were a group that we heard, and their manager actually was the actor that played Roxy, Neil Weston. And Neil had done some work with them, and they auditioned, and as a result of getting them, Neil was at that audition, and so we were talking to him, and we ended up hiring him to play a part in the film, and come to find out he'd actually done acting prior to that. So all of these things were back to happy coincidences.
Sure.
One other, David Arkin, who played in several Robert Altman films, he's just barely in the film, in the dance sequences, but he went on to do really well. The majority of his work did hit the cutting room floor.
Robert Altman. He's another one from In Summer Children, it ended up getting trimmed out, but yes. He had a really good run. He was part of your Robert Altman farm team.
Right.
He was in several films, and he worked with Zilnish several. So that's kind of
Did you shoot the dance party scene on Catalina, or was that somewhere else?
It was actually shot in Rustic Canyon in a gym at a Boy Scout camp.
That's in Pacific Palisades. It's between the Palisades. And what would that be? Brentwood, I guess.
It's very close to the Will Rogers Park.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that Catalina, things have changed, but a lot of it stayed the same throughout the years as well. A lot of it since the 60s. And I was just like, where is that building? I'm like, as a festival organizer, you're thinking, where's that space? I haven't seen that space on the island. And I'm like, that can't be on the island.
Right. So, we actually created some things. We spent a week for at least a full week, probably a six-day filming week on Catalina. And I flew back and forth a couple of times on the amphibian plane coming from Long Beach and landing in the water.
Great.
Coming back up onto the land at just a little above Avalon.
You're living the life.
Yeah, I'm jealous because they don't even have those amphibian planes anymore.
Oh no!
They're out there, but they don't allow them in the harbor. There's no place for them. But they look fun.
It was a Grumman Goose, and it was old then. So it would have to be probably a different kind of plane today.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they have a Grumman Goose in the air show. They have an air show there now that's going into its third year, and they're beautiful planes.
That's
Edie, you were saying something.
No, I was just thinking. You were trying to figure out where the Honey Hut, you know, the outdoor and indoor bandstand might be located. I think that would be a great addition to have for the summer. Maybe you can put one of those out there. If there isn't one.
if we can get that through the city of Avalon's council and figure out where there could possibly be land to build it, sure. If we can do it.
Sandy Gabriel, who played Candy, and the guy who played Ronald were one night during our week on Avalon, they had a dance contest, and the two of them entered it, and they won. And so afterwards, when people were talking about what was your most memorable experience over there, for them, they said, oh, the dance contest, of course.
That's funny.
Yeah. You know,
here come these professional entertainers winning a dance contest on Avalon.
Exactly. You know, there's a really beautiful scene, or sequence, rather, sort of a film noir flavor to it, in a hotel, and that was on Avalon.
Yes. In a hotel room.
Yeah, or in a hallway, in a couple of hotel rooms. So that was there. That took place there.
And I think I saw the Catalina Cottages when he was walking up the stairs to go to his bungalow.
Yes.
There you go.
I think that's still there, I believe. So it was kind of, it's really cool to see it, you know, kind of trapped in time. You used a lot of the locals, I noticed. And you know, how did you organize that, and how did you get them to, you know, focus on the scene as non-actors, as little kids? Did you just kind of find a group of kids and tell them all that they could be in a movie, or how did that work?
That was it.
A lot of those people haven't moved. You may see your relative in this film.
That's right. That's why I mentioned Ernie Reed having grown up there and then working his way over to Hollywood and being a technical person from before Summer Children to current day. Because I talked to him this morning, and he's on location right now doing helicopter shots for a TV pilot.
So I think that there's an interesting question here, though. Was it you who had to run around Avalon and try to scout up the locals and, you know, get some atmosphere, some background actors? Was that your job?
Yes, I did things. I would say my job as producer was primarily making things as easy as possible for Jim Bruner, the director, and Filmish, the cinematographer. And so we did have an assistant director, because I found out that I couldn't do every job. And so that was, but, you know, rounding up people to be extras or background was a constant job. Almost anywhere we went. And again, we were asking people to do it. We weren't saying for how much or anything, because we didn't have any money budgeted to speak of for those things. But it was all fun for them. So, you know, if you got 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the scene where he was marrying the mannequin, and, you know, it was very cute the way all the little kids were just completely enthralled in this scene.
Right.
And totally fearless. Again, and that, you know what, the thing that's so nice about that particular sequence is it's very childlike, and it's a playful atmosphere, and I think that was part of the Summer Children story, was they were being very playful, but they were starting to face really serious issues. So as we say, the tagline for the film is light obscures what shadows reveal, and there's like the sunshine, the California sunshine of day. Everyone's laughing, playing, swimming, joking around, you know, playing pranks, all that. But at night, things sort of came out from behind the shadows, and that's where there was a little bit more of a noirish tinge to the story, I think so. But during the day, there were those wonderful carefree sequences and scenes, you know, as you mentioned, with the kids and Muffy and...
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on KISO
88.7
Avalon.
Kind of a mix of good and evil.
Right? Sure. Were all those bridal shops there? Did you superimpose any of those well, not superimpose them, but did you create any of those shops that you felt you needed to? Or were they actually there on the island?
The religious artifacts shop, I think, was a creation or at least an enhancement done by Leon Erickson, the art director. The bridal shop, I think, was a bridal shop.
And the
hamburger stand was a hamburger stand.
It's still there, I think. So.
And the hamburger stand's still there.
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding.
It's identical. It's identical to what it is today.
Wow.
And so is the barbershop right behind them.
No way.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, Catalina hasn't really changed much. I mean, they're doing a lot of facelifts and you know, trying to bring in some different sort of elements and elegant shops and... But the architecture's pretty much stayed the same, and it was really fascinating to see what was there before. The bridal shop tells me a lot of people got married in Catalina, which they still do today, but probably enough to constitute an actual bridal shop, where today there's nothing like that on the island.
And probably there's no men's shop. I mean, there was a men's shop that we passed by multiple times, and I doubt that there's a men's clothing shop there now.
No, nothing. Nothing that's not just beachy sort of attire.
Right. Hey, do you still happen to have, there used to be a long time ago, I wasn't there for this, but I heard about it, the exotic animal park? Is this mythology? Or
there was the bird park, yeah, and that was something that they did have. It was like, what do they call it, the atrium, where the birds were there. And it's something that Marilyn Monroe used to love to go to when she lived on the island in the 40s. And that's a place where she would hang out. But, yeah, it's no longer there. I mean, I think now it's an actual children's playground, but the bird atrium's still there Mrs. Wrigley built.
Right.
Oh, cool.
It's a fascinating little place.
Buffalo? Do they still have buffalo on the island?
They do. The buffalo came in 1924, and they haven't left since. Now they're Catalina icons. They were brought by the Lansky Film Manufacturing Company was going to shoot a film with buffalo there. That it's now a big conspiracy about which film it was. Some people think it was The Vanishing American that Zane Grey had, but there's no buffalo in the movie. Some people are saying they're on the editing floor. They know the Lasky company brought them over, but they never shot the film, according to nobody finding a film with the buffalo around that time period. Now, I had a question about one of the shots that I saw, because I was looking for that famous, iconic casino building in the film. It was one quick pan where I saw it behind them. Is there a reason specifically why you didn't want to use that building in the film? Was it too much associated with Catalina? Were you trying to keep a European feel?
I don't remember any specific reason.
Okay.
It's funny. We've all remembered some things and not remembered others. The editor not remembering some scenes that he edited. Vilmos, the one thing that he really remembered because he said how scared he was is when he went to the top of the mast and shot down at the ocean and the boat.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he just said thank God he had a good assistant who was young and totally loved to run around the top of the masts and so forth. And so because he said how scared he was when he was up there, and he remembers that to this day, the first thing that he said when I called him about the reunion was...
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7 Avalon.
I've seen some great photos of you guys online and the Q&As, and what are people, you know, what's the feedback? Is it making it, you know, the labor all worth it?
I'd say that it has. It's unique. There's nothing else out there like the film. Everyone sees it and they completely get it. They understand it. They see it more than once. Oftentimes when we submit it, and it opens up so many channels from varying directions, because it is, you know, obviously the look and feel of it is very different from current indie films, but it just has this lasting value, you know, sustainable value to the film. And it also sort of combines what you can do today, but definitely by incorporating, you know, some of film's history and rolling that into filmmaking today. So it's interesting what it brings to people. Everybody, the larger the screen, the better. It seems as though more and more in the frame is revealed. There's more and more beauty. The larger the screen, the better to see this film, because Vilmish really had he was painting on a very large canvas when he was shooting this. And I've been amazed. I've seen it on every type of screen, from a phone to American Cinematheque's screen. And, you know, I worked on it frame by frame. I thought I knew every single artifact in the mise-en-scene, and I was blown away to find out there was more and more, you know, beauty that was revealed. And, I just, you know, people can't say enough about the aesthetics, I think, and also about the importance of film preservation. You know, it's the homage to this very collaborative, complex art form. And it brings up a lot of discussion around film preservation and, you know, transposing from 35 to digital. And, you know, we use digital intermediates in the restoration process. So it brings so many current discussions to the table. You know, when we were at Slam Dance, Kodak sponsored us, as well as Deluxe, and it was a critical period when things were really, you know, about to take monumental turns. So it seems as though Summer Children has always been present whenever there's massive changes taking place, and that's still going on. So it's interesting how it seems to fit in that,
yeah,
into that.
The Q&A, when we were at the Egyptian for American Cinematheque, the Q&A session lasted so long, they had to run us out of the theater. And it was funny because people just kept asking questions and asking questions. And so we just kept talking, and the next thing you know, there are the manager of the theater was running down the aisle saying, "You've got to stop. We've got to, you know, shut it down for the evening." So it happened all through great questions. One of the interesting statements that we heard a college professor make was, "This is grad school in a box."
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it was from seeing the film and then hearing your commentary. Yeah, the Vilmish's commentary is pretty amazing. You know, there's a lot to learn from. It's a really nice experience. Yeah.
There were generally good reviews from the screenings and from the festivals. So, you know, we know that there are weaknesses in the film, but we also feel really good about the work that we did to bring it back, that we had,
sure,
as high quality as we could get in Los Angeles for restoration help.
Mm-hmm.
And Vilmish gave of his time for the restoration.
Yeah.
So we just had a really good experience.
Yeah.
As you probably know, making a film is a gut-wrenching experience. And this was...
It's a labor of love.
Yes.
It is, it really is.
So it was that way for the first time, and this is one film that had two such experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the original film and the restoration. Yes.
So you had two sets of labor pains with this, with this love.
You got it.
So what do you, now you can go to the website. You want to tell them where, you know, they can get the film.
Right. The website is summerchildren.com, and we will it's listed at I think $14.95, and we will sell it for $10 on the website. So if anybody is interested, they can buy the DVD, which has one, besides seeing the film through once, you see it through a second time with Filmish's commentary, and also selected scenes that were taken out of the original film. So it has all of that, and there are also, you know, the reviews, if they Google Summer Children and Vilmos Zsigmond, they'll see some of the reviews as far as the film is concerned. It's also listed on IMDb, but I would say Googling it will see a lot more reviews and so forth.
There's a very nice article on the International Cinematographers Guild magazine that Bob Fisher, our moderator, and he's an honorary member of ASC and a terrific friend of cinematographers in Los Angeles. And so he was our moderator, and then he wrote an article that it really speaks to some really, really valuable points, and it's well written. So that's another piece to visit. The film's also available on Amazon.com in HD and also standard def, and you know,
you can either buy
movie has it for download. Let's see, it's on several VOD platforms, but of course, buying the DVD will give you all of those really cool bonus features. So.
Yeah, which is part of the piece of history, you know, and I think it really increases the value. I think, especially for the most of the film community that is interested in the, you know, the little details that you don't usually get just by seeing the final product.
Yeah, exactly. And especially this project, because it has such a backstory and it's had, you know, two lives. And it was an orphaned film. It was completely lost. And there's a whole story there. And then, you know, we found it. And it was, you had asked me, you know, what condition was it in? And we took it to the negative dustbusters before we got started. And it was really in pristine condition. We were very fortunate that the temperature had been pretty consistent.
Well, Jack, Edie, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time, and we look forward to screening Summer Children and bringing it back home to Catalina. It's truly an honor, and we look forward to your future work coming to us soon.
Thank you. It's a wonderful homecoming. I can't tell you just personally, I've had my eye on the prize, you know, for having an opportunity for Summer Children to come to Catalina. So personally, just for me, the restoration producer, I feel really honored and really, really blessed that the film is going to be making the rounds in Catalina.
Yes. Thank you.
The honor is ours. Thank you.
We are definitely the recipients of the honor. Please, we're glad to have it back, and we're glad to bring it back to its originating shooting location. But yeah, it's a great piece. We're excited to show.
Thank you.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on KISO 88.7 Avalon.